East mode, sand glorious. Cheat code in Babylonian, the Orient. My superhero got the people power. Yasin and Yasin, you should heed the hour.
With you and living kings, I mean it, I mean.
Chilling on CKUT 90.3 FM, baby. Out.
CJAM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells. First segment of our show is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, we'll hear Ash Ahuja's disability story. So, can you tell me a little bit about your disability story?
Yeah, my disability, so I was 11 years old. I'm 50 years old now. When I was 11, I got the flu, which was something that was going around. My entire family had it. And 2-3 days after the flu, I went for some blood work to the doctor's office since it wasn't getting better. And the doctor noticed that I was limping a little bit. So he's like, hey, go to a specialty doctor, like a neurosurgeon. And within a few hours that day, my limp went to inability to walk, to inability to stand, to complete paralysis, neck downward, within a day. In the ICU, in the hospital. So that happened when I was 11 years old. So this was, a diagnosis was not conclusive. Doctors thought all kinds of things, what has caused, but it was mostly the dengue fever, which is pretty prominent in India, which is where I was. And so, but it was, paralysis was neck downwards, both arms, both legs, everything. Except I never lost my sensory sensation anywhere. I could still feel everything. And over the next, I would say, 4 to 5 years with a lot of therapy, a lot of different treatments, Ayurveda, yoga, you name it, my parents took me to those things to try and see what can help. And it improved to a point where I use a wheelchair. I don't stand or walk because I don't have enough strength. But I do have some strength. So, like, now it's come to a point where, I would say, the last 34 years that I've been in a wheelchair, it's been, I'm independent. I do myself as well. Now, medical support. Pretty active, but still wheelchair bound.
So, can you tell me a little bit about your recovery? How did you keep yourself focused on recovering to the point at which you were able to at least use a chair?
Yeah, I would say since I was 11 when this happened, and what I found was first five odd years, it was almost 8 to 10 hours of therapy of all kinds that we were doing. Like, I would go to the therapist office, the OT, the physical therapy people, doing yoga at home, doing massages, Ayurveda. Like, it was nonstop. The entire day was just therapy. And I think it helped a lot. But after that, I would say I was spending so much time doing that that I was feeling like I'm not living my life at all. And I think it came to a point where I think almost, you know, around 5-6 years after the incident, I felt like I've done enough. I want to start living life now. So then my focus was on being more active and independent and trying to do more things, go out more places, see friends, you know, do activities. So I think what helped me going is more of that desire to live a more normal life and not spend all my time just doing therapy in the hopes that I'll walk again. My mindset was, walking is great, but it's not everything. I need to have a more normal life. And I'm pretty happy with that shift. And even now, I mean, I go through those ups and downs like anybody else, but I think I need to be working out more. Thankfully, for the last, I would say, 6 months or so, I've been doing that a lot more, working out more, building my strength. But there have been times where, you know, I put on weight and I don't think I'm working out as much. The thing that keeps me moving and driving is literally just wanting to be more out and about. So I've traveled a lot globally. That's something that I've loved doing a lot. I've done a lot more of that before COVID, not as much since then. But I've traveled a lot for fun, for work. I love driving as well. That was one of the first things, I think, which made me get a lot more confidence and a sense of independence when I started driving back in India. I think I was 18 or 19 when I started driving. And so that was a big motivator to, you know, see that, hey, this is something I can do. I can be independent. And what kind of strength do I need to maintain at least this level of mobility and improve it? So that's pretty much been the driver.
So in all your efforts, what's been the greatest success you've experienced? I know you have some connection to flight, for example.
Yeah. So I would say, the reason I was enamored by flight was because my dad was in the Air Force, in the Indian Air Force, since I was born. So I always saw him flying around, going for trips. Even my school in kindergarten was right next to a fighter Air Force base. So this was the Indian fighter training base where they would train fighter pilots. So, you know, even in sitting in school in kindergarten, you look out the window and you see these fighter jets taking off and landing all day long. And I would even know when my dad was flying at that airport that, oh, that's his plane, that he's taking off and he's landing even while being at school. So I was always enamored by flight. Had I not gotten paralyzed, my dream would have been to also join the Air Force as a fighter pilot or as a test pilot. That was my dream. That got shot when I got paralyzed. So that didn't go too well. But then when I started driving a lot, even before I started flying, I was going on the racetrack. I've gone to racing schools back in Connecticut, Laguna Seca, that's here in California, but I forget the one in Connecticut. I've gone to that a bunch of times. And when I found out this wheelchair aviators group on the internet by chance, and that got me intrigued into figuring out, oh, wow, this is something people are doing. Let me find out more. What can I do? So it took me a lot of time trying to figure out how can I make this happen. And I even went to a flight school in Atlanta because I was going there for a lot of my consulting work. I was IT consulting back then. And I found this guy who trains World War veterans, war pilots, to get back into flying after they've had some kind of a spinal injury or amputation, things like that. So I met him, went for a test flight with him, really enjoyed it, but I didn't live in Atlanta, so I couldn't do it. Then when I moved to the East Coast in Connecticut, I found a school that opened up in New Jersey. And the minute I saw them, I signed up, and I think I was their first wheelchair pilot that they certified through that school. So I've just been on the lookout since it was my dream since being a kid, just to get into flying.
So When you do fly, do you use any modified equipment or technique?
Yeah. So for flight, the biggest modification needed is for the rudder pedals, which are normally operated by feet for most normal pilots, and most planes have rudders and foot brakes as well. So those are things that you're doing with your feet, and the modifications that most of the planes that I've flown need to have is a hand control modification, where you can use one hand to control the stick or the yoke, which is to change the direction of flight in two axes, and the rudder is used for taxiing on the ground when you're moving on the ground, as well as the yaw motion when you're flying. And so for that, most planes that I've flown have a hand control adaptation that connects to the rudder pedals and gives you that control in your hands. And also because while flying, you need to control many things especially during critical phases of flight, like takeoffs and landings. You're controlling the ailerons, the elevators, the rudders, the power, the flaps. There's a lot of things going on. And if you only have two hands, you want to be able to do it all with two hands. So most of the planes have hand controls where the rudder and the throttle is in one hand, so you can use one hand to do both of those actions, and the other hand is on the stick that you use to control the direction of flight in two axes. And then some planes that I've used even have the throttle on your hand, so with your thumb you can change the throttle. So there's multiple modifications. The plane that I have has the rudder and the throttle on my right hand, and I use the regular yoke, which is used to control the direction of flight, with my left hand. And the last modification that they have is putting on hand brakes that I can use while I'm on the ground. So when you're taxiing the plane, or after you land back and you want to taxi back to the hangar, you use those brakes along with the rudder and throttle. So those adaptations have been made in the plane that I have, and also the other planes that I've flown.
I thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, Jeff Thiessen will be giving us an update on Thrive Magazine. So what's the latest with Thrive?
Hi, Cam. It's excitingly, we are now moving from a 3-time-a-year publication. It's a little bit awkward. It's typically, you know, once a year, twice a year, 4 times a year. So we are moving to a 4-time-a-year publishing format. That fourth issue, too, which I'm really excited about, is a little bit different than the others in that it's going to be a resource guide for the community, that being people, amputees like myself, those living with limb loss or limb difference, and for families, practitioners, healthcare professionals, just information that can help people when they're beginning the journey of limb loss, but also, you know, hacks and tips and tricks that seasoned amputees have learned along the way. So that's going to be our last one on the schedule in the fall that will be released.
So why the transition to a 4-times-a-year model, and what do you hope to achieve by increasing the numbers there?
Well, in my world and yours too, content creation is, we're content creators, right? And we always like to create more if we can. But we did find this gap in information in that that more resource type content that I described. I mean, the magazines, the other three have profiles, and we have a section called Mind Over Matter, which is, you know, spiritual in the sense of mindfulness and, you know, centering and just being more mentally healthy, for sure. And of course, we review different products, but we find that the ABG community has as much information as folks might think there are, is out there in the internet world. Sometimes it's hard to find, sometimes it's hard to sift through, particularly for our older readers. So we want to bring that to them in a one-stop shop sort of approach, and giving them the tools that they can refer to at any time, this year, next year, just a real resource, a tool for
So, that being said, I'm guessing it's going to include some tips and resources for dealing with the mental health side of having a limb loss or a limb difference, because the start of that journey, as I've covered many times, can be just overwhelming and a sense of shock.
Definitely. I mean, there's the grief component that people go through with loss of a limb. You know, that can be followed by social isolation. And we all come with our own implicit biases, stereotypes, and assumptions. We can't help that. Our brains are wired that way. And the influences and the lenses that have shaped that can be cultural, religious, personal experiences. So all of a sudden, someone ends up being an amputee, being in the disability community, that they may have real stereotypes or biases or assumptions about. And we really want to try and help them get past that social stigma that they might be experiencing. I mean, for any new amputee, this, you know, staring is problematic at first, and for some all their life. Helping folks understand that, you know, there's difference now, but that can be embraced and I don't say appreciated. That be I'm looking for a different word to explain that, but to help them get through those initial struggles of living differently in a world that they once knew.
So, sort of a way of looking at compensating. You can't do it one way, but you might be able to change it to be done another.
Yeah, definitely, and that's, I think across the board in the disability community, we're great adapters, compensators. I've heard it said we're the best problem solvers in the world, and I certainly know that as a double arm amputee. You run into a slippery round doorknob for me, and right away I need to be thinking, okay, how am I going to manage that getting in? And if it's a restroom door, getting out as well. And, just different ways of getting through our everyday daily living activity. So, and that changes once becoming an amputee, being an upper extremity, an arm amputee, or a lower extremity where mobility and fatigue and pain now become much more prevalent in their life.
So, do you have any advice to any new amputees out there for ways they can sort of keep their head above water and start looking at the world from the standpoint of what's possible?
Yeah, and where would I start with that? I think most importantly, and just to step back, a lot of people feel very alone after they lose the limb, like they're the only ones in Canada or wherever, their town, their village, their city. There is that feeling of the disconnection, for sure. And peer support, and maybe expanding on that a little bit, appropriate peer support, finding someone that is like them to talk to and see where they are on their journey. Finding someone of the same age, same gender, same interests. And that can be done through amputee support groups, through their prosthetists, through rehabilitation professionals. Really important to seek the company, and I don't always say advice, but company of others that are a little bit further down that path or that journey.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Always a pleasure, Cam. Thank you.
Of course. Andy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
You're missing a couple of strings on this bass guitar. Is that how you learned it, and you never bothered to buy two new ones, or is there a plan?
After 2 years, I mean, what's the point spending money and a lot of it? It's like two is enough. It's adequate. Anybody can play this bass.
Revolution Rock airs Saturday nights, 7 to 9 p.m. on CJAM 99.1 FM in the Windsor, Detroit area.
We are a syndicated award-winning radio show that broadcasts 60s garage rock, 70s punk and new wave, surf, alternative, indie, and old and new music within these genres.
You can also hear us online at cjam.ca, iHeartRadio, and visit our website at revrock.blogspot.com.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Ash Ahuja shared a little bit of his disability story, and we heard the latest from Thrive Magazine from Jeff Thiessen. In this segment of our show, David Taylor will be telling us a little bit about ALS Canada. So what's the latest with ALS Canada?
Well, from our organization's standpoint, and I think what hopefully, you know, your listeners would be really interested in is that we're currently pushing very hard to try to have the Ontario government support the organization's care and support mechanisms, as well as their access to multidisciplinary care through clinic.
An ALS patient.
Yeah, so I'll tell you, the first thing that comes to mind is I'm actually not the best person to ask, even though I have been in it for a long time. I would say asking a person who's living with ALS is the best person to ask, because they're going to be, you know, really be able to tell you what it's like, because I certainly, you know, can sympathize, but I'll never know what it is that they truly have to go through. But it, really, it's from the moment of diagnosis, a person who maybe never heard of the disease, doesn't know where to go, needs to find information. Do they want to participate in research? How do they get the right type of care? Are they getting the right type of care? And then they have barriers in terms of getting access to great care. That's what we're asking the government to help support, because we need better multidisciplinary care at the clinics. We know that that's a great model. And then as the disease progresses, it, you know, every day is a new hurdle and a new step as it progresses. And that comes with it, obviously, physical things to deal with, but also, you know, the psychological aspects that it takes as a toll on an individual, on a family. Money is another issue. It's a very expensive disease in a lot of ways. And, for a lot of people who may have to leave work or leave jobs, caregivers who might have to leave jobs, it can be incredibly difficult for individuals. But I'd say they would know better than I would any day of the week.
So what are some of the supports your organization provides to those affected?
Yeah, so our organization has a really robust community service program. So we actually have individuals known as community leads who are in different areas around the province. They will, once registered with us, they will go into the homes. They'll help navigate all the local systems. I myself, if I was diagnosed with ALS, I wouldn't know what the local things are in my area that can provide me that support. We also have an equipment pool, so we will be able to help coordinate across the province for people to get anything from walkers, other mobility aids, wheelchairs, lifts, things to help with stairs, all kinds of different things that can help them to manage the journey. And then there are support groups, there are webinars that are offered for information, and then our organization has a whole other mandate around research and advocacy. But from the day-to-day for individuals, I think our community services is really where we shine for Ontarians who are diagnosed with the disease.
So how do you reach out to the patient community?
Yeah, so in various ways, we have all kinds of communications. We do through social media. We obviously have a website. We're rebuilding a website. We try to do as much awareness, like yourself, who can opportunities to get the word out. When someone is diagnosed, we really try to make sure we have a good and strong connection with the clinics so that they will explain to them that we exist. Those individuals can then register with us, and then we can absolutely start the process of getting involved in helping them in whatever way they choose to and whatever way they need.
So in your time with ALS Canada, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Yeah, oh, there have been lots of success stories. So I've been with ALS Canada for about 12 years. I'm actually the national VP for research. And so from a research standpoint, we've come an incredibly long way in our understanding of the disease. We now have some more approved therapies, but I think we're on the way to more robust therapies. So that's an exciting piece, because once we can start to weave that in alongside the support and care, this is when we can make a difference on actually slowing down the progression of the disease someday, maybe even stopping or curing it. But even from a standpoint of what we can provide and what we can do, you know, we've been able to achieve certain advocacy goals of having extension of compassionate care benefits alongside other charities. We have better benefits for certain military individuals who may carry a slightly higher risk for ALS. And we are really hopeful that this provincial ask that goes in to help people both get better care, provide better care for people in northern and rural areas of Ontario, and then to allow our equipment program and our community services to be covered by the province, not by donors. We're really excited and think that this has a great chance of potentially moving forward, and that would be a massive, massive win.
So what would the ideal outcome be for this ask? If you could see anything added to the existing services and what's available for ALS patients, what would you like to see?
Yeah, right now the ask is really focused on $6.6 million a year, which would come out of the provincial budget to be able to support. So if someone is diagnosed with ALS, they will have certain set of funds that help them, that follow them around to the clinics, in the sense that it will help to boost what clinics can provide. So the best model of ALS care is widely known around the world as multidisciplinary care. Actually, an interesting story, because it came largely out of a gentleman in London, Ontario, as well as someone in San Francisco many, many years ago. But the care is not still perfect, in the sense that it takes a lot of infrastructure and a lot of different individuals with different expertise to do this proper multidisciplinary care. So the funding would actually help boost the clinics to be able to do that. It would also offset completely our community services and equipment program, and make sure that provisions are better for people in rural areas, which would allow us so much more funds to be able to do valuable research and ultimately be able to find better disease-modifying therapies. So yeah, the $6.6 million would just be an incredible change in how ALS is approached in this province and across the country with what it will leverage.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thanks. In disability life, my friends, the key is always adaptation, finding what works for you. Now, it's not up to anyone to tell you that you can't have this dream or that dream, that you can't achieve this or that goal. For someone like Ash, who found a unique and creative way to still do what he loves to do, this is a great example. Because honestly, in disability life, it all comes down to determination, deciding what you want to do and what might make it possible to get there. Yeah, a lot of times you're going to hear everyone's perception of what you should and should not be able to do. People love sharing that opinion. But honestly, they don't know your strength. They don't know you as a person. They don't know what you have achieved, nor what you will achieve. It's up to each one of us to establish that for ourselves. Oh yes, we can choose to live with the glass ceiling idea. We can choose to take someone saying, you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you don't move this way or see that way. We can choose to take that as gospel. We can let it become set in stone and hold us back. My question is simply, why? Why would anyone limit themselves to that? For the fact is, we can't know what's possible and what's not until we get out there and try it for ourselves. Honestly, that is the very basis of progress. People love to point out what doesn't work in the world. I think in disability life, we're about finding ways of making things work. Perhaps it's true we don't do things in the way others would expect, but if it works, I think it's the result that counts most of all. And disability life is all about thinking outside the box, using our creativity. If you need a hammer and you don't have one, use a pipe. But honestly, each one of us is responsible for figuring out our own hopes and dreams, and deciding whether or not we're going to take a chance to get there. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
Yo, check 1, 2, this is Flavor Flav, Public Enemy, and you're listening to CKUT and the place to be from the bottom to the TOP.
99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
To HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. The first segment of our show is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, we'll get an update from Rabia Ketter from Disability Without Poverty. So what are some of the key areas that Disability Without Poverty is working on at the moment?
Well, we've continued with our Budget the Benefit campaign. As you know, Cam, the bill became law in June of this year, and now we have entered into the process of consultation for regulations, and there's still no budgeted amount announced by government.
So, in terms of the issues of poverty and disability themselves, what are some of the key areas that you'd like to get changed once the policy is finalized and formalized?
Well, again, there's the government consultation tool has been launched. It's an opportunity for people to give their advice, and it's open to every Canadian. It's important that every Canadian recognize the issue of disability poverty, that most disabled people who are unable to work due to no fault of their own are living in poverty in this country if they are not gainfully employed with a livable income at minimum. They are living at least 30% below the poverty line, in fact, if they are depending on provincial benefits like ODSP. And for a person with a disability, their daily cost of living is 30% above the poverty line because they just don't have the luxuries that able-bodied people have of choice. And hence, they cannot stretch their dollar beyond the barriers they face necessarily. So, for example, if a disabled person does not have a vehicle, they're depending on either purchasing groceries online, which cost more than in-store, or they're depending on having somebody take them, and they can only go to, like, one place because they can't ask somebody voluntarily to take them to three different places, or they cannot pay for transportation that drives them around town to catch all those deals. So daily living costs are more, and the income people with disabilities receive is significantly less, so they are living in dire straits.
So I'm guessing this is
basically a cycle process in so much as I know poverty could be a generational factor. If one group doesn't break out of it, then be passed along to future generations.
That too, but for people with disabilities, I mean, if you're able-bodied today and you lose your job and you don't have appropriate benefits and supports, you can very quickly find yourself in poverty.
So, do you have any thoughts as to how persons with disabilities can self-advocate and sort of break the cycle?
Well, again, right now we've undertaken ourselves through the movement building work that we've been doing and engaging people. We have reached a significant number of people across the country at the grassroots level from various walks of life who live with disabilities and or are caregivers of people with disabilities. We have launched our own Shape the CDB project to make sure that the viewpoints of lived experience are documented and made available to government that they may or may not capture through their consultations. So we have engaged over 4,500 people through our online questionnaire that will help flush out what those key questions are that regulations and policies and policy guidelines for implementing ultimately the Canada Disability Benefit should incorporate. So, you know, how the benefit should be made accessible to people with disabilities, how income testing should happen, how people with disabilities, you know, the income threshold that's set should account for cost of living with a disability on top of, you know, the income reality that they face.
So I'm guessing one of the key areas to consider is matching the proposed benefit with inflation. It's fine to give somebody X amount now, but
that you know, ongoing, like the benefit should be indexed to inflation. We shouldn't budget, like, you know, $500 today is not $500 10 years from now. I'm not saying this is the benefit amount. I'm just using that as a figure of speech, right? What we can buy with a dollar today, 10 years from now will cost us maybe $10. Who knows? So we want to make sure that the regulations recognize that there will be that kind of change over time.
So have you seen any positive steps being taken toward this movement? Any successes that give you hope that ultimately this will be something to actually help persons with disabilities?
Well, I think it's up to us to make sure that we encourage and empower people in positions of power to use that power to make the change we need, to make those tough decisions of budgeting an adequate benefit without, you know, other competing interests going ahead of the needs of people with disabilities. It's time to put the needs of disabled people living in poverty front and center and first priority in this country. We know that everybody in public service means to do good, has the best of intentions, does not intend to create barriers. What we're appealing to people in positions of power, whether it's political power or bureaucratic power, is let's put our hearts and souls into bringing out a benefit that truly lifts people with disabilities out of poverty. We're at a critical time of systems change, the kind of systems change we haven't seen since public health care in this country. Let's make the change we need for tomorrow, because every one of us, those of us that don't live with disabilities, unlike you and me, Cam, we are both disabled. Yes. People who do not have a disability today may have a disability experience tomorrow. So recognizing that 100% of us may require this kind of social safety net at some stage in our lives. If we fall into difficult times, let's do the right thing today to make sure that we change the system so people with disabilities don't have to depend on food banks, don't have to ask for charity on the streets or online. They shouldn't go without food or affordable housing, safe and accessible housing and you know, basic necessities of life. They should be able to afford a haircut. They should be able to afford over-the-counter painkillers to manage a headache to get through their day and get their daily living activities done.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you for having me again.
It's my pleasure.
In this segment of our show, Jess Lewis will be giving us an update on her training efforts. So what's the latest with your training regimen?
So we just got back from competing at the Pan American Games in Santiago, and I was very excited to come away with the gold medal in the T53 100 meter. That was kind of the race that we were really focusing on going into it. And I was going into that as the defending champion from Lima in 2019. So to be able to defend that title was absolutely incredible.
So what steps are you planning on taking to get ready for the next event?
I made a lot of changes this year with changing my coach and moving to BC to train with him full time. Right now, we're kind of still in our build phase, and we made a lot of different adjustments to my racing chair, the seating position, as well as the push rim size. So that's something that we're still filling around with going forward. But we will be racing in Dubai in February, so I'm excited to get another month of hard training in and see where we are then.
So when you travel to compete, do you find there are a lot of accessible environments that you get to see?
Yes and no. There's definitely some areas that are tougher. But I think when, you know, we're going to these competitions, we're kind of in a little bit of a accessible bubble, if you will, where, you know, they make sure that everything is accessible because we are coming into that space. And then we obviously don't get too much time to sightsee just because our season is so short. So we usually come in, we race, and then we leave. So we're definitely always in kind of that bubble of accessibility.
So when it comes to the races themselves, do you find that parasport still offers the same energy and drive as the able-bodied equivalent?
Absolutely. I think, you know, there is obviously a lot more awareness coming out about parasport, and that's just evident by how many more spectators we have at competitions. And I think, you know, people are really starting to realize how amazing parasport is. And, you know, it offers a lot of different aspects to it going into, you know, a race and watching people. So I think just that awareness is there and more people are talking about it and becoming invested in it.
So that being said, if you could see anything added to the awareness of the games, what would it be?
Probably just more of an increase in how it's televised. Because I know for a lot of the able-bodied sports, there usually is always like a live stream and like catching the events live, where a lot of the time for parasports, it's always kind of like the highlights or the recap of the day. So I think definitely having more broadcast would be amazing.
So you mentioned some changes in the way you're training as of this year. Can you tell me a little bit about what's worked and what hasn't?
Yep, so the biggest change that we made was to my racing chair. To the seating position that I'm in. So we actually lowered my knees about 27 degrees. So I'm sitting a lot lower, and my whole body is kind of in the frame now, as well as moved me forward a bit, so my push rims are a little bit further behind me. And that's just come from, you know, research that coaches have done around the world on what is the most optimal position to be in to get the most power into your stroke. So that was a huge difference, and that is working really well. In Chile, in Santiago, I was doing the 100 in 16:71, which is like my second fastest time this year and probably ever. You know, we're kind of heading in the right direction with that. And we've also switched to using a smaller push rim size, which we're still trialing out now, but I think I am seeing a little bit of a marginal gain in my starts, so that's working really well. We also changed my start mechanics, so where I start on the rim, I'm starting a little bit higher up, which gives me a longer first push, and then transitioning into the shorter stroke, which is working as well. So I think we're definitely heading in the right direction going into Paralympic year next year.
So what you do takes an incredible amount of strength and endurance. How do you keep your mind sort of centered, pushing past the pain and keeping your eyes on the prize?
Yeah, there definitely is tough days, but I'm just so fortunate to be surrounded by an amazing coach, Jeff Harris, as well as all of my training partners who, you know, we always push each other to do better. And on those days that we're struggling, you know, it's easier to be in a group that can, you know, help to motivate you to just keep pushing through it. And one of the biggest things that I've started doing this year as well is having a little bit more access to like massage therapy and physio, which has been very, very beneficial with my recovery and just, you know, muscle pain in general.
So what's the ideal outcome for the next round?
Hopefully a podium finish. I would be very, very excited for that. And, you know, it's something that we're definitely working towards, and we kind of know the steps that we need to take in order to get there. So it's just all about putting in the work now and really focusing.
Light, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure, thanks for having me.
My pleasure, as always.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
So you're hanging with your inner circle. Maybe you're making cocktails. Maybe you're packing bowls. Even while we're distancing, it's important to remember, alcohol and cannabis each mess with your driving skills. Be cool. Make sure you and your friends get home safe. Take a cab if you need to. A few bucks could save a life. And we can do it again next weekend. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Rabia Ketter gave us an update on Disability Without Poverty, and we heard a little bit from Jess Lewis about her latest training efforts. In this segment of our show, Moshe Turner will be giving us an update on the NYSER Foundation. So what's the latest with the foundation?
So I have redefined the mission for the foundation because it turned out that the original concept just really wasn't able to go. I just couldn't get funding for it. It just was too far outside the box for most people to think about. And so I've been using it more or less as a bully pulpit and a way to support my my current focus, which is to write articles for publication in scientific journals and medical journals that address issues about narcolepsy that are not addressed in traditional texts, because there's a lot of things that are involved with narcolepsy that are not documented very well, or if at all, there's a lot of problems with the narcoleptics getting misdiagnosed, or their physicians not understanding what's going on with them, not understanding how different drugs work differently on narcoleptics than they do on ordinary people, and so forth. So I've had some success with that. It's a little difficult for me to write these articles sometimes because I only superficially understand a lot of these things. But I don't really do any original research anyway. What I do is I take an idea and then I support it with a lot of references to the existing literature, and just present a different way of looking at it with a point of view that addresses these issues. And that's also, I'm working on something that is in the very early stages. I'm working with another nonprofit that I'm on the board of about us doing some kind of group housing, sort of like an assisted living sort of arrangement for specifically for people with narcolepsy. But that hasn't gotten very far yet. That is an early stage product that I'm just starting to work on.
It's fascinating. So in your efforts, have you ever discussed anything related to the issues of employment when it comes to those with narcolepsy?
Yeah, that's a constant topic of discussion with people with narcolepsy, because people with narcolepsy are sleepy, and when they're not properly treated with drugs, they have a hard time functioning, and a lot of people have lost jobs and had other employment issues. I don't know why my phone, let me just make this thing be quiet. A lot of people have lost their jobs, been disciplined at work. They've been called all kinds of things like lazy and unmotivated and so forth. It's a problem. And they have a hard time sometimes getting accommodations, even under the ADA, if they work at a suitably large company. People just have a hard time understanding that you're so sleepy that you can't do your work. So it is a topic that gets a lot of discussion, and I've written letters a couple of times for people who are trying to make claims on their long-term disability insurance that they get from work, as well as letters supporting people's applications for Social Security disability insurance. It is something that comes up.
So do you have any advice to both the public and leaders in business and steps they can take to better educate themselves about narcolepsy so they avoid falling into the pitfalls of the myths you described earlier?
You know, narcolepsy, I call it a non-communicable disease because it is just impossible to explain. You know what an elevator pitch is? Have you ever heard that expression?
I have not.
It's something that that salespeople do, that you have to be able to say what it is you're doing, what are you selling, and why you should buy it in 30 seconds, like if you're in an elevator with somebody, right? But there's no elevator pitch for narcolepsy because it's so, so complicated and so hard to understand. You know, when somebody explains something to you, what you do while they're talking to you, you look around in the file cabinet of your mind for something that matches what they're talking about so you can try to understand what they're saying. But with narcolepsy, when you describe all these things about narcolepsy, all people have in their filing cabinet is tired, sleepy. You know, and I say, yeah, I'm tired, I'm sleepy, so what's so special about you? They just can't, they don't have anything to work with to try to understand it. It's just way outside the comprehension of most people. And there really is, it's a very difficult thing that you're talking about, and a lot of people have tried. A lot of ink has been spilled, a lot of words have been said, and there is still today no really concise, clear way to describe narcolepsy to somebody so that they can understand what the problems and the challenges and so forth are with it. It's very difficult.
So if you could see any one thing added for those affected by narcolepsy for their benefit, what would it be?
Well, that would be that's a very difficult question. I guess, you know, what narcoleptics need the main, if you ask a narcoleptic what they want more than anything else, apart from being cured of their narcolepsy, they'll tell you they want to be understood, because it's just incomprehensible to most people. So if you can't understand, I guess the next thing you could do is be compassionate, you know, and say, well, I don't understand, but I see that you're having a problem, and I'll try to help you as much as I can. I guess that's the only thing you could do in that case.
So, do you typically find that the medical community is well-versed on narcolepsy? That if someone goes to a doctor and says, I'm perpetually sleepy, I think this might be narcolepsy. Do you find that such a doctor would be responsive or willing to believe the person?
No, usually when a person goes to a doctor and says, well, I'm tired all the time, because they don't use the right words. They don't know enough to say that I'm sleepy. They say that they're tired. Doctors hear you say, yeah, I'm tired. You're tired all the time. Well, I'm tired too. You must be depressed. Here's an antidepressant. In fact, it's the number one misdiagnosis that people get for narcolepsy as they begin their diagnostic journey. I had a primary care physician who was smart enough to know that he didn't know. And sometimes I'd go for an appointment at his office and he'd have an intern there. And one time he took the intern and me, put us in a room, and he said to me, tell him about narcolepsy. And he closed the door and left us alone there because he knows that I know more about it than he does. It's very difficult. Most physicians only know what they see in the medical text. I asked this intern how much time they devote to this subject in medical school. And he said, no more than 20 minutes.
It's terrible.
So you can see why people don't have really comprehensive understanding. It is getting better a little bit, but you know this, like everybody who says they're sleepy today, their doctor sends them for an overnight sleep study to see if they have sleep apnea, because according to the sleep apnea lobby, everybody has sleep apnea and they need to buy a machine. So more cases of narcolepsy are being discovered than used to be because people are getting sent for these sleep studies more frequently today. So that's a good thing. But I think a certain number of narcolepsy cases are misdiagnosed still today as something that they're not really narcolepsy, but the guys who are making these diagnoses are not really qualified, and they just throw up their hands and say, oh, it's narcolepsy. There was a study that was done some years ago where they had about 1,000 clinicians who are members of the American Association for Sleep Medicine. I'm sorry, that's the name of the that you get to be a fellow with. And only about 20% of those clinicians who filled out the surveys said that they were comfortable identifying all of the 5 primary symptoms of narcolepsy. That's incredible. Those are sleep medicine doctors. It's very poorly understood. They're very poorly educated on it. And it's rare to find a clinician who really gets it.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay, Doc.
Thanks. One of the great tragedies in disability life comes from the misunderstandings that come from conditions we're not overly familiar with. It's not something we can readily see or quantify, or something that makes sense in our bubble of the world. We start to assume, maybe this person doesn't have a condition. Maybe they don't need our support in the same way. Truth is, somebody says they have something that's affecting them. It's up to us to keep an open mind, to listen, and to understand. Just because it's something that's physically taxing in a way that we're not familiar with ourselves doesn't mean it's not having an impact on the person, and it does not change their right to contribute in society. It's the same as saying, I'm going to impose this glass ceiling because my understanding doesn't fit this. You know what you do in that case? Expand your mind. Allow yourself the possibility to see beyond what you're familiar with. And maybe lend a hand of support to someone who needs it. Conditions like narcolepsy, and even things like mental health concerns, are always the first
to get this sort of misunderstanding, I think. In so much as people like things that they can put in a nice little box. They have a framework for. They have their own understanding of. But disability doesn't always work that way. And we as a society must keep growing. We must continue to understand. We must allow ourselves to think beyond what we understand right at this moment and continue to grow in this way. Serve our fellow human beings that much better. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
Avec un crisse de gros E à cause que c'est toujours bien la base d'essayer d'inclure tout le monde. Pour celles qui nous connaissent pas et qui nous écoutent pour la première fois, tout ou pantoute, c'est comme le Kansas que Dorothée veut donc retrouver tout le long de son épopée à Oz parce que, tu sais, home is where your heart is.
Oh. Aujourd'hui, on vous présente une entrevue réalisée avec la sexologue et psychothérapeute Maëlie Giroux-Dubois, avec qui on s'attarde à la façon dont on construit nos relations et aux barèmes relationnels imposés par les limites et besoins des différents individus.
Puis, on va conclure avec une participation spéciale mais récurrente de Tout ou Pantoute revisité à la fin de l'épisode, une collaboration qui nous fait bien triper puis qui va vous faire regretter d'avoir fait stop avant la fin si jamais c'est votre genre.
On commence cet épisode-là, drette-là, à la vitesse où Steph accumule les pères pour ses enfants dans la galère. Puis non, on la juge pas, c'est notre personnage préféré.
Oui.
Ici Alexandra Turgeon, en direct de Trois-Pistons sur le bord du fleuve.
Et Laurie Perron, en direct de Villeray dans la Grand-Ville. Vous écoutez...
Tout ou pantoute!
Si l'invité du jour a un rapport professionnel au thème de la construction des relations, pour moi, elle y est aussi très intimement liée. Maëlie Giroux-Dubois est sexologue psychothérapeute, cofondatrice de la clinique de sexologie Perspective, située à Québec. Elle a pratiqué comme travailleuse sociale et pratique encore à titre de sexologue dans plusieurs organismes communautaires. En 2018, elle a participé à la création du livre « La couleur de l'adoption », qui est le premier livre de portraits de personnes adoptées réalisé par des personnes adoptées, que vous pouvez vous procurer au lien que je vais mettre aussi dans les notes de l'épisode. L'an dernier, on a pu l'entendre au podcast « Where We At Montréal », qu'on aime beaucoup.
Oui.
Et accessoirement, mais vraiment pas tant que ça, à cause du contexte de,